This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station. 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 3rd of January. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Tan Chung Han here with me.
Good morning, folks. Good
morning. Third day of the year. I'm still writing 2017.
On your checks? Is that what it is?
No, no. When I type 2017. Yeah. Yesterday, I had to go back and correct a document that I had typed. I think we're going to see a bit of that in the first few weeks or at least a month of 2018.
The teething period of going into 2018.
For sure.
I know. I feel your girl.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll take a look at news overnight as we start our day today. Over in Israel, the Israeli government has issued a notice for thousands of African migrants to leave the country or face imprisonment. So the migrants have been given up to $3,500 for leaving within the next 90 days. So essentially, the Israeli government is saying, okay, here's some money. Mm-hmm. You have to leave the country. Either you go back to your home country or you go to a third country, another host country, but we don't want you within our borders.
Yeah, so essentially they've got 90 days. If they do not leave by April, the Israeli authorities threatened to start sending them to jail. So quite the drastic move here. It appears to be a purge of African migrants into Israel there.
Yeah, so essentially the migrants are from places like Sudan, where they come to Israel to seek asylum after fleeing persecution and conflict. Mm. But, you know, this is not a new move by the Israeli government. Israeli government have been for years now offering migrants, or African migrants specifically, cash and then a chance to go and live what is supposed to be a kind of safe haven in a third country. But more often than not, it's just as a measure to get them out of the country. And where you go after that is really not the Israeli government's problem.
And some of the language being used by a government spokesperson is rather troubling as well. So a spokesperson for Israel's Population and Immigration Authority told the BBC that there are currently 38,000 infiltrators in Israel.
So they really do, you know, very xenophobic. Yeah. And don't want to have any other
infiltrators.
Yeah. That's quite a term there. Mm. Well, let's move on to another piece of news that has gone viral overnight. The YouTube sensation Logan Paul has made headlines and prompted a barrage of criticism after he posted a video which showed the body of an apparent suicide in Japan. So apparently, Logan Paul and his friends went to Aokigahara Forest at the base of Mount Fuji. That place is known to be a frequent site of suicides. And what he did was, I think, He took a video of him and his friends, and they came across the body of a man, an apparent suicide victim, and they took a video while making comments and jokes around the body. But what really troubled me, Han, was the fact that the video is not live, so it's not like he, you know, did an Insta story and then happened to stumble across something. Mm. He edited it and then put it up at a later point in time.
Right, because the face of the body on the body was blurred out. So there was some post-production involved, yet he still decided to post it online. Now, just to give the other side of the story, Logan Paul has since apologized. You know, he says he's disappointed in himself. You know, he talks about how he was misguided by shock and awe. Well, perhaps that misguidance continued during the post-production process
But it's so troubling because this guy has 15 million YouTube subscribers.
Have you seen his stuff, like Logan Paul?
I haven't, but I know that he made the top 10 list of the Forbes most YouTubers that made the most money last year or something like that. Right. Yeah, he's you know, quite famous.
Yeah, he is. You know, he's done stuff with The Rock, for example. You know, so I've seen his stuff, but I've not seen this video. Unfortunately, you know, his rather celebrated career on YouTube and on social media, you know, obviously taking a big hit given this really, really unsavory
incident. Well, we'll have to see, Han, whether netizens will accept his apology as sincere. Well, it's coming up to 6:05, and after this, we'll weigh the benefits of studying abroad. Stay with The Morning Run, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 9 minutes past 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 3rd of January. I'm Melissa Idris with Tan Chung Han this morning, and that was Sting with Englishman in New York.
Classic, right?
I love that song.
Especially that sax at the end.
Yeah, yeah, wonderful. Good riff there. So, speaking about being somewhere abroad, now, for many of those who are just done with SPM exams, the start of the new year could also mean the start of their journey into tertiary education. It's also the start of the education fair season, where convention centres and exhibition halls are filled with marketeers that attempt to sell their courses to prospective students. Now, I've no doubt that one of their best-selling points will be the idea of a foreign experience or studying abroad and all the benefits that that brings. But what do we make of this overseas experience? Is it all that it's set out to be, that it's all marketed to be? What do you think, Han? I mean, you studied abroad, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. So just to set the stage here, I studied abroad. No, I stayed abroad for over a decade, I think. And you did not, right?
Your education did. So I did my first degree locally, and then I did my master's abroad.
Ah, yeah, that's right. Okay.
Yeah, so I got the benefit of having both experiences.
Right. I'm definitely a proponent of studying abroad, broadly speaking, I mean, because of the merits of, say, learning how to be independent, you know, having cross-cultural experiences and being, you know, thrown out of your comfort zone and being forced to adapt to other people's value system and culture, etc. Right. So I think that is an experience that obviously cannot be replicated from the comforts of your own home base. Mm. Right?
I do have to say, though, I mean, going to study abroad for your undergraduate degree, you're really young,
right?
You know, and then you're kind of leaving home essentially for the first time. Mm-hmm. So going abroad, so I think that the overseas education is really not just about what you learn in the university or in the classroom, right? So that's that. I mean, there's so much to be had by learning in universities locally or abroad, right? But it's that experience of leaving home and being by yourself in a foreign country,
right,
without your mummy and daddy to help you. Yeah. And I think that is one of the benefits. Some people swim, some people sink a little bit in the beginning. Oh.
You know? I mean, I thought you were talking about it literally for a while. I'm like, no, Mel.
Not
we've
quite
got planes now.
Sure. Well, some people, I mean, not swim to the university, but you know what I mean, as in terms of they probably miss home a little bit or, you know, abuse the freedom too much in the early days.
Certainly.
Right?
Now, unfortunately, this is a trend that I saw on many campuses in the States and also what I hear from student groups in Australia, right? Unfortunately, many Malaysian kids who then go abroad because these foreign universities have twinning programs with the local institutions, they go by batches, right? So when they go over there, they just stick to the people from home. So you've got this little Malaysian bubble on that Australian campus, or this little Malaysian bubble, you know, in this university in Michigan, for example. So unfortunately, I think that dilutes the experience of being able to get an education abroad. I'm fine, you get the paper degree, but when it comes to the secondary effects, right, say being able to make it on your own, carve out a life, you know, interact with more of the local stakeholders, that unfortunately is being missed out on.
All right, so we're going to put a pin in the discussion about the quality of education locally versus abroad, because exactly as you said, we're talking about the secondary benefits, right? So what do you get by going abroad to study apart from the what you learn in the classroom? What did you get from being away from home, Han? You know, at such a young age, what do you feel that contributed to your life skills?
Well, I guess without going into the details of my life story, essentially it gave me a huge launch pad, right? I come from, well, you know a bit of my background. So essentially, you know, I came from some pretty unsavory episodes after the Asian financial crisis.
Okay.
So being
tough times.
Yeah, tough times. Mm-hmm. So being able to go to the States and get that degree allowed me to relaunch and reshape myself. I think that was absolutely crucial and played a key part in leading me to where I am today.
Did it make you more independent, you
reckon? Oh, big time. Yeah, big time.
As versus if you stayed at home. Because for me, I feel that that was the case for me.
Yeah, and looking at college grads, you know, from local institutions here, you do sense that they, well, I guess I got to apologize if I sound patronizing, but there's almost something lacking, though, because the experience here is very, very far removed from what you would experience overseas, right? Here, for example, you know, getting jobs may not be the norm, at least for the private school kids. You know, now, granted, they come from a pretty well-to-do family to begin with, right? But as opposed to, say, overseas, many, many international kids will then have to work, right? So automatically, you don't just have to fend for
you
yourself.
You mean get a job while studying.
Right, because you're allowed to work part-time on campus, at least in the States. I don't know about Australia and the UK, right? So that itself just adds a whole other dimension. So you got to be really responsible managing your studies at the same time being able to work that job to fund your education.
I was, when I was in university, I made a little bit extra money being, you know, giving out flyers and also being an usher. And I tell you, and it was really humbling. So I now always take a flyer from whoever I see because I've been there standing for 10 hours.
Sympathy points, yeah, yeah.
No. Sympathy points.
I feel, yeah. No, so I've been a dishwasher in the States. The works. I used to clean, for one summer, I cleaned the toilets of the men's football team. And
oh, wow.
It was a troubling experience. It still scars me to this day.
All right. Well, tell us what you think. I mean, do you think that going over, what are the merits of going overseas? Apart from the education, do you believe in the benefits of studying abroad? Tell us what you think. We'd love to hear from you. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899. Or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Coming up to 6:16. And after this, why it's so hard to say goodbye to Ampang Park on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Hooked on a Feeling by Blue Suede. Good morning. If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Morning Run with me, Melissa Idris, and Tan Chung Han this morning. Coming up to 6:19, we were just talking about the benefits one gets from studying abroad, whether that's worth the money spent. Nick Hasudin has weighed in on Twitter. He says that he learned how Australians treat their politicians. I have to say, Nick, exactly the same thing. I studied in Sydney as well, and it was during the elections then. And I think really a bit of a culture shock because I learned that it's okay to make fun of politicians on TV. And I was so surprised. I was like, wow, does no one get caught by making fun of the Prime Minister on TV? And it was really quite eye-opening for me to see how Australians treat their politicians. So I agree with you, Nick Hasudin. Thanks for tweeting in.
Nice. Good stuff. Yeah, and likewise, I produced a radio show in college during the 2004... Wait, hold on. I can't remember which year it is now.
One
of the elections. Yeah, I know. A long time ago. Yeah, so that was eye-opening as well. Just seeing the mudslinging, you know, on air that goes on. It's
it's quite interesting.
Yeah, quite
Liana's also weighed in on Twitter to say that students need to immerse themselves in the foreign experience.
I agree,
not
Diana.
To keep within Malaysian cliques.
That's
cliques.
Right.
So totally can tolerate differences and gain a worldview, she reckons.
That's there right. She's my best friend right now. Well
she
done.
Agrees with
yes.
you. Well, tell us what you think. Weigh in on Twitter and and join the conversation. Our Twitter handle is at BFM Radio and our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899. All right, let's take a look at Ampang Park, which closed its doors for good on Sunday. Now, hordes of people were at the mall, mostly nostalgic from nostalgic from having, you know, their lives touched by memories of that mall. So, What about you? Do you have any memories of Ampang Park? Hun?
Actually, no. As a clang boy, true and true, right?
We never
made it that far up the Federal Highway. I guess we just stayed on the outside.
Fair enough.
So, I don't think I've ever stepped foot into Ampang Park. I mean, sure, I've passed it, you know, multiple times,
right,
but I've never been in there. So, unfortunately, I guess for some, and I don't have that emotional connection. So this may be a non-story for me. Well, in my mind, if the markets have decided, well, it's not economically viable, close it down, I'm like, well, close it down. Obviously, there are many KL folks and many of you listening right now who think otherwise. So
I'm not from KL, so I didn't spend, this was not my first shopping mall, for instance. It was for a lot of people, but it was the first mall at my first job. So I worked near Ampang Park and it was where I had lunch almost every day for 2 years. And, you know, it was where I set up my first bank account in KL. Ampang Park represented to me my first foray into adulthood. I was an adult and I had to open my first bank account and then register KWSP and did all those things.
At Ambang Park.
And had to pay for my own meals because mummy didn't pack my lunch for me anymore.
Right.
So all these things really, for me, I have memories of that place.
Right. So
but am I being overly nostalgic here, hun?
Well, I wouldn't say overly because obviously, given what you've described, Ambang Park plays a, you know, it is a great milestone. It's a marker in your journey in life, right? So I can see the nostalgia. But I think the question here is whether or not we should get emotional over these economic decisions, because obviously this was a market-driven decision, right? Mm-hmm. Whereby Ambang Park in itself, well, there's a lot of value in that land that could be unlocked, right? We often hear that phrase, the unlocked
That's
value.
That's true. It is in right. the heart of town.
Right. You know, so unfortunately, Ambang Park, that site as a mall was no longer, you know, economically viable, then so be it, right?
Well, so there were a lot of op-eds and, you know, people weighing in on social media to say, oh, you know, this is what I you know, this is what I'll miss about Ambang Park, or this was the place where I would buy, you know, my tapes and my
cassette tapes
and all that, and where I, you know, I went dating last time when I was a teenager. So I think it brought to mind that the question, are we being overly nostalgic or sentimental over a shopping mall, essentially? It's not even, you know, could it be classified as heritage, given that it makes KL?
Yeah, and while we were talking about this story before we got on air, you know, I was kind of thinking, well, you know, given what I said, you know, if the markets or if the economics of it just doesn't work, then we should just tear it down. Well, would the same argument apply for, say, your heritage buildings, right? Then my instinctive reaction was no, because they offer a lot more to the historical landscape of Malaysia, you know, at least from an architectural perspective, right? Whereas a mall is just a mall, if I can put it that way. Obviously, I'm treading on thin ice.
No, I don't think you. I don't think you do.
Wait, with Ambang Mall, you know, well, even though it means so much to you, you're okay with these kind of comments.
I'm okay because I think it reflects our dependency on malls. That there's a certain shopping mall culture that we have in Malaysia, where most of our memories seem to be tied up to malls. I mean, it's not the park or the beach. It tends to be malls because we spend so much of our lives there. I think the Ambang Park closure has really brought to light a discussion about mall culture in Malaysia.
Okay. So it represents this concrete structure of, you know,
so
overt
attached
consumerism, you know, like this is materialism at its worst. Forget you, Ambang Mall, is that what they say?
Well, not really, but I've just come to realize how much of my life I spend in a shopping mall.
Yeah, that's true.
A lot of memories are made there. Friends are, you know, friendships are solidified there. You know, it's not just to go and buy stuff. It's leisure time, essentially, right?
I actually like malls because, you know, of the sheer convenience, right? We lead very busy lives over the week. But on weekends, you can run multiple errands all within the same space, right?
So one-stop center.
Yeah, and plus there's air conditioning as well. There's great food, everything, right? So it's very convenient. I'm all for malls. Unfortunately, with
not Ambang Park, because you're a Klang boy for life.
That's right.
That's what LS has said on Twitter. Big shout out to you.
Yeah, what's up? K-Town.
All right, we've got Valerie by Amy Winehouse coming up next and the 6:30 news. So stay tuned on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings there with Better Things. Coming up to 6:38 right now, I'm Melissa Idris with Tan Chung Han. And earlier in the morning, we were weighing the pros and cons of studying abroad. Lots of you have weighed in on Twitter and WhatsApp. And we've got a message from Fauzan from via WhatsApp. He reckons that studying abroad gives a valuable experience in being in a different environment. It broadens our worldview and teaches us how to respect local cultures.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. Tell us what you think. Do you think that studying abroad is worth the money for the life experiences that it brings you? Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 and our Twitter handle is at BFM Radio. But Han, there was this news item or this ad that caught my attention. It was reported in the BBC this morning, and it turns out that Philip Morris, that huge tobacco giant, in the UK, they placed an ad in some of the papers there promoting what they call their ambition to stop selling cigarettes in the UK. So Philip Morris, essentially, it's, you know, it's the world's second largest tobacco company, but they're saying that they want to stop people from smoking, create a kind of anti-smoking country in the UK.
Right. And that isn't entirely foreign because you've got JTI. We had them on the Breakfast Grill here, the managing director of JTI Malaysia, G. Silva. Folks, you can check out that podcast of the Breakfast Grill on the BFM app, which you can find on the Apple App Store and Google Play, right? So you've got, and even during that grill, right, you got G. Silva actually saying that they don't want to get new people to start smoking. What he said was, we're going to have those existing smokers actually move up the value chain. Basically,
what does that mean?
So, mean like shy away from illicit cigarettes, and make sure you pump back more revenue into the legal trade and hopefully boost their margins there.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, so they're still saying smoke cigarettes, just don't smoke illicit cigarettes, right. Smoke our cigarettes is what they're saying.
But then he's also saying, we don't want, that's what he says, we don't want new smokers. But when you look at it from
that's
a market perspective, that doesn't make any sense,
that
right?
That doesn't. Right. No, yeah. Philip Morris, for instance, with this article, this is part of their plans for the future to achieve a smoke-free future. I'm just wondering, this really struck me as strange because this is a company that is, profits are driven by the number of people who smoke, right?
Right. So I guess given the healthier habits and more of a heightened awareness, for the ill effects that come from smoking, I think it's time that the likes of Philip Morris, JTI as well, they're having to adapt to these trends. So, I believe e-cigarettes is an alternative that they're really looking at, even JTI, that's Japan Tobacco, the parent company, they're looking to go into, say, pharmaceuticals, uh-huh. Pharmaceuticals and even food as well. So they're having to diversify, because of the, I guess, some of the fundamentals when it comes to smoking, the market fundamentals, that's being threatened right now.
Well, okay, so I guess what's interesting with this specific ad with Philip Morris, it's a huge ad, and it was, the text was, our New Year's resolution, we're trying to give up cigarettes. Mm. And, all the anti-smoking campaigners came out and said, well, this is just a PR stunt. If you really wanted to stop people from smoking, then just stop making cigarettes. To which the company replied, well, if we suddenly stop selling cigarettes tomorrow, others would sell them in our place, which is back to what you said about illicit cigarettes, right?
Right.
Is that a fair comment to make, though, Han?
Well,
you reckon?
Okay, look, I see this as a healthy engagement between corporates and social pressure, right? The fact that they are reacting to social pressure, I see that as a positive, So, fine, there might be questions being posed about its sincerity, fine, and those are legitimate because, it doesn't make market sense to say that we don't want more customers, right? But, hopefully, we will see more of these big tobacco players responding to not just the changing lifestyle habits, but also perhaps more of these pressure groups, right?
Well, for me, it kind of marked a trend for me because I noticed recently that there are, say, oil companies that are sponsoring ads or sponsoring shows that says, this is the how to save petrol, right? Beat the jam and save petrol, or giving petrol saving tips from petrol companies, essentially oil companies. And I was like, wow, that's really strange. But it's also a really clever marketing ploy. And I thought, wow, my goodness, what a sneaky way to get your message in, to kind of sound like you're promoting the opposite of what your business implies, because you know that your business has a negative impact either to the environment or to somebody's health. So you go on the offensive and say, well, actually, I'm trying to help the environment by helping you save fuel and not get stuck in traffic jams or burn that much fossil fuel.
Right.
Do you think that it's also just a way, because of the strict advertising laws, that it's also a way to get their name out there using PSAs?
Well, I think so, because it's not all just dollars and cents. A brand's equity can also be measured in, say, PR value, right? So if an energy company goes out there and says, hey, we have these green technologies or very efficient ways of getting our resources, that then adds to the brand's value out there in the market space. You know, so people are more endeared, perhaps, or at least less apprehensive about that particular brand, be it these big petrol companies or big tobacco companies, right? So I think it's a trade-off. Yeah.
Well, you know, these big tobacco companies like Philip Morris are already making attempts to move into alternatives to cigarettes. So they own brands of e-cigarettes and other kind of tobacco, non-tobacco products, for instance. Which, for me, I'm wondering, is this it? Is this the mark where we might see the end of big tobacco? But then again, we don't know the benefit or the harmful effects of e-cigarettes because it's just not been long enough to test the effects, right?
So, right. And there's been some flip-flop in government policy as well. I think there's an export ban and things like that. So, yeah, who knows?
This is going to be interesting times to keep an eye on big tobacco. But it's 6:45 right now. And after this, we're going to be looking at what's happening on our home ground ahead of GE14. Can we expect more women to run for office next on BFM 89.9? BFM 89.9, 6:48 right now. I'm Melissa Idris with Tan Chung Han this morning. We're the morning run as we take a look at some of news making headlines this morning. But earlier this morning, we were talking about the pros and cons of studying abroad. What do you gain by living independently abroad? Now, most people have weighed in on Twitter and WhatsApp to say that they gained experiences by living independently, learning local cultures and making new friends. However, on the flip side, Suresh Raj has weighed in via WhatsApp and said that when he went to school abroad, he started doing all sorts of unsavory things. I'm not going to mention them on
our
family-friendly radio, all of which Suresh says that he wouldn't have done if he had studied locally around his family.
Hold on here. I mean, this is a bit of a false dilemma because you could get involved in these naughty, naughty activities even here at home, right? You have college kids who are involved in vice activities. But net-net, I think it's still a positive experience to be studying abroad because you don't get that cross-cultural experience, at least not in the kind of dosage that you would.
Right.
Dosage, it makes it sound like a drug treatment or something. Not in the same kind of dose that you would over there versus here, right?
But you know, what he's trying to say is that being around family would probably help keep you in check as opposed to when you're too young and alone for the first time, away from family for the first time. What do you think?
There are authority figures at these foreign universities here, you know, so there are those systems in place. Really, it's up to you. You can get involved in these negative activities abroad and at home.
Well, tell us what you think. Or do you think there are benefits to studying abroad as opposed to, being too young and on your own for the first time, whether that opens you up to all sorts of unsavory behavior? Tell us what you think. 018-789-8888. Or tweet us at BFM Radio. Now let's come back to what to expect ahead of the 14th general elections. Now all eyes will be on a meeting happening later today where it is expected that there could be announcements made with regards to the upcoming elections. But Datuk Nancy Shukri, the Batang Sadong MP, she has come out to say that she's hopeful that more women will be fielded as candidates in the upcoming GE. So 24 women, I think, are currently lawmakers in Dewan Rakyat at present.
Yeah,
that's not a lot.
Yeah, 24 out of 222, so that's about 10%. There's so much for the 30% club in Dewan Rakyat. And so I guess Dato' Sri Nancy Shukri's call is rather timely, given that we are just months, maybe
even
weeks.
Exactly.
I don't know. Away from GE14, and if either BN or Pakatan decided to field more women female candidates, I think that's a step in the right direction. Right?
Definitely. So she says that let us see in the coming election how many women candidates will be nominated and how many will actually be voted in. So she says that this is in despite of her not being in favour of the 30% quota for female senators, as suggested by the Prime Minister, Datuk Seri Najib Razak, on conditions that Barisan won the upcoming GE14. So to get a better understanding of the arguments involved when it comes to the 30% quota, for and against quota, we spoke to Angela Kugatas, the Executive Director of Empower, an organisation that works on political equality in Malaysia.
Well, first thing, we have to understand quotas, right? And quotas basically are placed because you want to correct an imbalance. And so it's a temporary special measure. It's not meant to be like something that you implement, you know, and not review. So for me, the quota is necessary, considering the context of Malaysia right now, how women are not better enabled to, you know, to take part in politics and to also to be better able to play their role once elected.
And with GE14 just around the corner, we also asked her if she is hopeful that women will have more representation this time around.
I can only hope that they will feel more candidates, you know, and recognize that there's a need to take risks with women who may be less experienced, but also to provide that support. Otherwise, you won't see the change happening. The other thing that I also want to point out is that having these quotas is not enough. You know, they've got to also address the sexism that's there, the misogyny that's there, that takes place in Parliament. You know, how some women MPs are attacked just for the way they look. You know, for example, like YB Theresa Kok, you know, the kind of insinuations that have been made. So I think political parties need to also have, you know, their own guidelines as to how they behave, you know, as elected leaders, yeah?
That was Angela Kugathas, Executive Director of Empower. So interesting there. So we've got MP Nancy Shukri saying that she is not in favour of the 30% quota for female senators, whereas Angela Kugathas saying that, well, she is, but with a caveat that it should be a temporary measure.
Yeah, and I guess this is the good old debate between, say, meritocracy, whereby you feel the candidate based purely on merits, not by gender, as opposed to, say, something that is more affirmative action, right? Like these quotas. So I would have to side with Angela here, because it appears that, you know, the natural forces are not lending itself towards, you know, having more female participation in the elected representatives in the one right yet, right? So there has to be some form of artificial force, if you will, you know, that being the quota. So I think it needs a shot in the arm of sorts.
So you reckon that policy-driven measures would be better than waiting for organic growth, which, you know, historically hasn't happened at
right.
a rate we want?
Yeah, because we have these imbalances because of how the market, so to speak, you know, have grown organically or not grown organically, right? So at the end of the day, I think lawmakers, and that's what their role is, you know, in many instances, right? Not just in economics, not just in politics, education, etc., right? It's to perhaps set policies in place that can give it a boost. And then hopefully the organic growth will follow suit, and then it can become the status quo, you know, later on.
Yeah, so for me, I think, yes, I'm willing. Something fundamentally I'm opposed to is the idea of quotas. But
sure.
In this case, I think Angela has the right idea in making it a temporary measure. So just get your foot in there, and then hopefully it will take root organically.
And hopefully it doesn't become a crutch. I think that's key
yes,
there. Yeah.
Definitely so. All right, it's coming up to 7 o'clock. We've got the bulletin coming up at the top of the hour in just under 4 minutes. So stay tuned to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, the business station. Hello and good morning. If you've just joined us, this is The Morning Run. 6 minutes past 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 3rd of January, 2018. Not 2017, as I keep writing. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Tan Chung Han. Good morning, folks.
Good morning. We're looking at the news this hour. Everything you need to know as you start your day. The front pages of the papers this morning, as well as the top headlines in the business pages. But first, we were talking earlier about the benefits of pros and cons of studying abroad. And we've got lots of people weighing in with their own experiences. Mokhzani Muhammad has also weighed in on Twitter. And if I could read his his tweet, Han, he says that on the benefits of studying abroad, I had the opportunity to study locally and in Adelaide for a number of years. And when I studied locally, it was all about getting grades, about getting B grades. But when I lived abroad, I became a human being.
Whoa.
He said,
whoa.
Isn't that deep? Isn't that deep? He said, it was all, he became a human being when studying abroad.
You know, Adelaide is such a popular spot for Malaysian students, right? I recall going to my good childhood friend's wedding over there. I was seated at his table everyone else was a Malaysian doctor but me. Oh, it's like this like little mini Malaysia in Adelaide over there. It's like, good God.
Well, I'm glad that we've heard from both sides. So there are people who say, well, you know, they got a lot from studying abroad. And there are those who said, well, I got into so much trouble being in, you know, on my own so young. So perhaps I would have benefited from being around family and having that kind of support system.
Yeah, unfortunately, what does that say about the state of our education system, though? Be it both public and private, whereby, you know, you got students shying away from local institutions and, you know, finding their opportunities abroad. You know?
Well, yeah. We're going to continue this conversation.
Yeah, that's a discussion for another day.
You can weigh in anytime. Our Twitter handle is at BFM Radio and our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899. Thank you to everyone who's joined the conversation so early this morning. But let's take a quick look at some other news. We've also got news about cyberbullying. Now, this was the education... this came up from the Education Ministry. They say they will be formulating guidelines to tackle incidents of internet abuse, especially cyberbullying among students within the country.
Yeah, so you got Deputy Education Minister Dato' P. Kamalanathan saying that cyberbullying was one of the main examples that the ministry was looking at in light of students being more tech savvy. So he also said that while guidelines on students' behavior and conduct have always existed, the ministry needs to improve on it by including cyberbullying as a current issue that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, so essentially they're looking at the inclusion of cyberbullying in the behavior and conduct guidelines, which will, you know, probably take into consideration both parties, right? Both the students as well as the teachers. Mm. And so to understand how these guidelines work in tandem with the existing laws and policies, we spoke to lawyer Fung Cheng Leong, who specializes in internet and cyber law. We asked Cheng Leong to talk us through the laws that are currently in place to address issues such as internet abuse.
Well, the existing law, one of them is, of course, if we're talking about online, then it's Communication and Multimedia Act, which governs the misuse of internet, whereby, for example, obscene or harassing messages are sent. Then, of course, there are offences under the Penal Code for criminal intimidation. So it really depends on what type of bullying is it. So if you're talking about, let's say, online harassment, then there's also civil suit one can file against another person.
We then asked him, with the proposed guidelines, what practical recourse can students or parents take?
Well, if student is bullied in school, what the school can actually do is just to take the complaint and discipline the person who bullies the child thereafter. But what if the incident happens outside the school, outside of school time, and whether the school can actually take action, that of course I'm not sure. Well, the guidelines may help. It's a stepping stone. But again, whether would students understand these guidelines and the information, the knowledge in the guidelines have to be imparted to the students to tell them, you know, you got to follow all these guidelines and you got to comply with these guidelines. Of course, students, they will have a problem accessing lawyers to take legal action for them. The best they can do is go to their parents or their guardian to take the action for them. If that parent or the guardian has no access to lawyers, what they can do is, of course, still file a complaint to the school. Or if it's a more serious type of bullying, then they can go to the police to take the action.
And that was lawyer Fung Cheng Leong, who specializes in internet and cyber law. Now, we also spoke to Datin Noor Azima, who is the CEO of Parent Action Group for Education Malaysia. We asked her what she thinks of this move.
Well, I think it is long overdue. I mean, cyberbullying is not new. We've seen it, happen in developed countries. It's even lost lives. And we have been watching from afar. And I think some parents are aware and they advise their children, but there's no formal guideline. So this looks like it's a good time to introduce this. But at the same time, MCMC has been doing programs and giving lectures, and I think they've got some YouTube videos ongoing as well, which they show to the public and to small crowds. So So I think this is something that the ministry can emulate or work with MCMC to do this. And I also think that to attract the attention of students, it has to be visual and it has to be, again, through YouTube. This is what works. And YouTube actually shows how this is done or, you know, how it manifests itself. And it's clearer in a visual way than if it was written, you expect to get children to
be,
which they don't.
That was Dathi Nur Azimah, CEO of Parent Action Group for Education Malaysia. Mm. That's quite interesting, the things she said, Han, because I completely agree. I think that if it was written, and you know, you'd expect children to read it, but they really won't. So something visual like a YouTube video would go a long way in spreading the message.
Certainly, but also I think it's important that we highlight that public policy only goes so far. I think these kind of problems, be it bullying, crime, you know, any kind of social ill, has to be tackled at the grassroots level. I mean, for example, you hear, I mean, all these public policy, you know, or campaigns or public campaigns, you know, say anti-smoking or anti-truancy, you know, or talking up the merits of an education, etc., right? But how effective is it? Because you still have smoking, you still have crime happening, etc. Fundamentally, it has to happen at the grassroots level. More parent involvement, for example, other agents of social control, be it teachers, peers especially, I think that's crucial. Being able to foster that culture of saying anti-bullying values at that level, I think that is the first and utmost, I mean, most crucial step.
You know, I think that many of us, our generation, kind of parents especially, who don't understand the real impact of cyberbullying. You know, we say bullying because we think it's about pushing someone around in the playground, right? Mm. Or you know, that kind of bullying in school. But cyberbullying is a whole different level of psychological torture in itself. And many of us who didn't grow up, you know, being having to deal with this, maybe we don't really understand what that can do to a young child, you know, especially someone who perhaps craves that peer recognition, the validation from their peers.
Right. And as I guess in conventional bullying, if there's such a term, you know, it is, I guess, rather limited, right? It just happens in that playground. Where else in cyberbullying, one so-called cyberbully or troll can target multiple victims. And I think that, unfortunately, is the dark side of the internet, right? On one hand, it's liberating, sure, but at the same time, it gives platforms to these trolls and these cyberbullies to target many people. And so it obviously has to be curtailed. It requires a multi-pronged approach. Public policy, sure, but like I said, you know, earlier, fundamentally at the grassroots level as well.
I'm also curious to know what roles teachers and schools have in kind of curbing this, right? Because we talk about, you know, we heard from the lawyer who had, okay, there's laws in place here. MCMC is doing all that it can. Teachers and as parents are also involved in trying to educate the children. But where do schools and teachers come in? It often almost happens at a punishment level. So this is more about, you know, conduct and punishment guidelines.
Yeah, so right? Is it reactive, right? As opposed to perhaps some proactive measures. Mm. No, sure. And I guess this is where the guidelines come in. It tries to be proactive in nature. Now, as a teacher, it's going to be tough, right? Because very much of what we do is within a classroom. Now, I do have WhatsApp groups with some of my classes.
Oh, that's nice.
Right? And I try to, you know, make sure I inculcate, you know, certain values. So not just good grammar, but also being able to respect people's time and being courteous when messaging each other. If they ask a fellow student about a certain homework, and I make sure that it's done in a courteous way, etc.
Oh, no. Good.
Right. Now, so you have those measures. But when it comes to say other social media platforms, I don't have the time to be tracking my dozens of students. No way, right? So I've got plenty of grading to do as it is. And I'm sure all my teachers out there, you know, holler at me, you know what I'm talking about, okay? There's just plenty of administrative work to go by. You're going to add the patrolling of your students' online activities? Nuh-uh, I'm good.
Yeah, someone has to take charge though, but it has to be a kind of concerted effort. All right, it's coming up to 7:16, and what we're going to do is take a look at the front pages of the papers after this, so make sure you stay with The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.